Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see 100,000,
600,000 deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor." Every check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. He said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you're going to jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out to Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming. Sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up. Because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
4 years ago, we started a microgreen farm. We started growing microgreens at home in our living room. And today we got to the point where we maxed out a room of 300 square meters. So today I'm going to give you a little tour of the room, and I'm also going to give you some really good tips for if you want to grow microgreens at home or you want to make it into a business. I'm going to give you those tips in the end of the video. As you can see here, we're growing a variety of different kinds of microgreens. We basically turn this into a business where we are delivering microgreens like this in trays, still alive, for over 1,000 restaurant companies and catering, cafes, everything in Denmark. So we learned a lot on this journey about how to grow the product really nice so it looks fresh and it's the shelf life is really high in this product. And basically we grew from growing in our living room to growing in a basement to growing in a 10 square meter little room to 100 square meters, and now today we are operating in our own building where we have 300 square meters. In the back we are growing mushrooms, as you saw in some of the other videos, and we really turned this into a way of living for us. We are employing around 30 people here in Denmark, with expanding into Czech Republic. Hopefully soon we're going to expand into other countries as well. So this is like a really fun business to operate because we are in the process of communicating a lot with chefs. We're communicating with other gardeners, and it's like a product that's alive, so it's really difficult to maintain the freshness if we don't sell it in the right way and if we don't sell it in the right time. If we sell it a little too late, then maybe the customers don't like that the product gets too big and the quality diminishes. So if we sell it a little too early, then the product hasn't fully grown out and some people think it's a waste of money. So we really have to maintain a quality that like looks good and fresh all the time, and basically that's one of the hardest thing about doing a microgreen business, because that's what they don't tell you. It's really difficult to sell the product if you don't know how, and it's really difficult to maintain a stable quality. So yeah, we came around all those things and it worked out really great, and now we are doing 25 different varieties of microgreens. So I'm gonna take you a little tour around the room and you can see what we are doing. So you can see here the peas, they are really nice and fresh. We are growing these in different sizes. We're growing them really tall, or we're growing them like this tiny petite peas. They are really, really great. The smaller peas, they are much more fresh in flavor and texture, but the bigger peas, they just give a lot of spread on the plate. So the chefs who wants to use big peas, they want a lot of produce on the table. So yeah, some people like them tall, some people like them small. So this is, for example, our lentils. You can see here, they are really nice and fresh. We can grow them under strong light or we can grow them under less strong light. We found that some species work really well under less strong light, and under strong light we need to grow other species. So the way that the light is, that if you are using white light, for example, then the taste of the product is much more sweet. If you are using a violet light, it's a bit more sour. The violet light is more intense, it's more efficient in energy consumption. However, it's not so nice working under violet light. We have a lot of young people working here, and we don't want them to use like special LED glasses when they're working in here. We just want a really nice, clean work environment that doesn't give you a headache or gives you a bad like sense of seeing, because you get all green in your eyes after working in a violet light for just 10 minutes. So it's really bad for your eyes because of the UV. It's so intense in the violet. The white is a bit more easy to work in. You don't need goggles. You can see here we're using the white light with red spectrum, a little bit of yellow in it. and a small amount of blue. We're using the Paris LEDs, so Paris Europe, we can highly recommend. It's the most efficient LED light for microgreens that we've been working with. We've worked with many, many LED producers like Samsung. We worked with Kind, with Spectrum King, with Fluence as well. And we found that Paris is really, really the best light for herbs, salads, and microgreens. So shout out to Sandro from Netherlands. Thank you for some high quality lighting. We really enjoy working with this, and we are growing really nice product within this light. We're moving a little ahead. So as you can see here, for example, we have some sunflower, nice sunflower growing here. Basically, almost all the shells are falling off by themselves. And we are in this room right now, turning around, I think, with the mushrooms in the back and the aeroponic system over there that I'm gonna show you in a minute. I think we're turning around $20,000 every week right now. So we've expanded a lot since the last video we made, and you can check it out right here if you want to view that. It's really interesting working with all these. It's a live product. It has to be sold within 2 weeks maximum, because if the product gets a little too high, for example, we can see the peas here. They are like reached a point where they are about as high as they can be, because after around 5 days more of growth of this, then it's getting really difficult to store it on cool, because you have a much reduced shelf life in it, and it's not good for business growing the product too much. So you want to grow it as high as this maximum and then deliver it, so you can make a new crop on the same space. Basically, all the space we have here is like around 2 to 3 weeks, and then it gets rotated, so we get new crops all the time. You can see here we have some garlic that's been growing, and it's really fresh. Give it one more week maximum, and then you can't sell it. So you have to all the time make sure that you're doing it in a way that makes the product not bad, but as fresh as possible all the time. This is the aeroponic system that we are operating. This is a system produced by Next Food in Denmark. It's operating only basil and parsley right now. We tested some lemon basil. You can also see that in another video. In the back, we have Hjalmar. He is also one of the partners. Maybe you saw him in another video, but he is watering right now. So in all the microgreens we're growing, we're still watering everything by hand. And some people may think that that's insane, but since we have so much, we're spending like 1.5 hours every day watering. But we just figured that it gives us the best product possible, and we don't want to go on any compromises on the quality. So until we found the right watering solution for the way that we are growing microgreens, we are going to water it by hand. The aeroponic system that we have here, it's really nice. It's automated. We only put the plugs in, and then 3 weeks later, we have these fully grown basil and parsley herbs. We change the water in the tank, and then we give it fertilizer, we measure the pH value and make sure that the plants have everything they need. The lights is gonna be changed to Paris LED as well. So this system, it uses 2,500 watts, so 2.5 kilowatts per hour. With Paris LED, we're gonna reduce that to around 1,000 or 1,500, so 1.5 kilowatts per hour. Maximum, I think. Hjalmar, he's watering right now. He's watering all the special herbs that we have. We are growing some shiso, some marigold, some basil, and yeah, basically some really different exotic herbs that you can get on your normal greenhouse. This is Tobias. He is working with us, and he's been working with us here for some time. He is one of the young people as well, helping us with everything we need. And in the back, behind the camera, is Rasmus. He is also one of our young people. He is actually cutting all the videos that we are doing, and he's doing a really good job. We are just trying to make everything work here as efficient as possible with the space that we have. And sometimes it's a challenge, but yeah, we are working very close with the chefs and with the other restaurants and the wholesalers, so we know all the time what people want and what they like. Alex, he is not here at the moment, but he's gonna be part of another future video for sure. He is the director, the CEO of the company, and he's also one of the creators of microgreens here in Denmark. Regarding the watering in the whole production here, we started testing these drippers. So we have a water tank, an irrigation tank in the back, and with connected with a computer and a pump, and then this is watering 2 times per day. Then underneath the trays, we have a big tray to collect the water and make sure that everything is watered from the bottom. And we are just still testing this. We tried testing it on the peas as well, where we had drippers everywhere, and that didn't work out so good. So we also started testing this system here, and it's a sprinkler system. And maybe I can show you how it works. We are also testing this system. This is a sprinkler system. We don't know if it works yet, but we are testing it. So I'm gonna show you how this. So it's basically like just putting the water everywhere and sprinkling the water all over the trays. We don't know if we can make it work so that it like reaches everything and all the trays at once and doesn't water too much in the middle. That's one of our issues right now. So we want to see if we can make it work, and if not, then we are gonna see if we can work with some other kind of way to do the automatic watering. But so far we are hand watering everything and making sure that the product is the highest quality that it can be, because that's what we want to deliver. We don't want to compromise anything or work with bad products. We believe in what we do, and we believe in that a system like this can be set up so you can grow locally herbs, microgreens, salads, mushrooms, and deliver them to your local restaurant, your local canteen, cafeteria, whatever, and maybe provide more fresh food for the local environment in your area. So as promised, I'm gonna give you a few tips on how you can become a profitable microgreen grower. So the first tip is basically that you should not see this as a way of like making money from day one. It takes a lot of time to get the product right, to get the communication right, but once you have the product right and the communication with the chefs, then it's a really nice business to work in. So the second tip is to just provide great service all the time, provide the best service in your area, make sure that your product is more fresh, much more beautiful looking, because that's gonna give you an edge over the competition. And the third lesson I'm gonna give you today is that you want to grow this locally. So if no one is growing anything like this in your area locally, then you have an edge, because people want to get more local food and they want to supply and provide with people who want to work with products like this locally when it's grown the closest to the plate as possible. Thank you for watching the video. I hope that you got some knowledge out of it. I hope you got some ideas about how you can start a microgreen business, or like what not to do now. And yeah, basically, if you have any ideas for future videos, let me know in the comment section, and something you would like to know. And yeah. subscribe to our channel and give this video a thumbs up to make everyone love microgreens. So have a nice day.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
That's what you're saying.
No, that's not true. I have no idea.
We really need our own systems. And what's unfortunate, like when you look back historically, when great men have taken a stand to make us all strong and all come together, they were gunned down. They were assassinated because it's just so much power within the Black community that they just want to suppress it because we came over as, they say, slaves, but we were doctors. We made universities. We had the first paper. You know, we had so many things, and they just want to dumb it down. So I just don't know why we just can't come together. When we did come from the mud and being beat together on a boat together, why can't we just go together?
That's not true. But before anybody ever gunned you down or before anybody killed any ancestor, the people that looked like you and the people that were supposed to be in your corner hated you and killed your reputation first. The only way that they're able to infiltrate and to be able to kill you and gun you down is by first killing your reputation. Even if they kill you and you become a martyr, and in a lot of instances, you become a lot greater and have a much bigger impact than if they were to leave you alive and let you fumble, right? The first thing that they ever did, and even if you go back to any of the people that a lot of people don't even agree with today, right? They're still killing Martin Luther King's legacy right now, right? Mm-hmm. Right now.
And we letting them.
And you know the interesting thing is about that? If you go back and you study history, most Black people didn't even like Martin Luther King. Most Black people hated Martin Luther King. Most Black people hate the very thing that is best for them. In every single instance, in every single part of society and in every single era. The very one, the one that is the biggest advocate for you, is the one that you hate first.
Yep.
They don't even have to do anything to you. It ain't them that's killing you. It's you that's killing you. We kill us first before anybody can ever do, say, or touch anything about us.
What's that? Aaron, damaged neural perception?
I got an understanding of why, from my understanding, who I talk to and what I've researched on why a lot of black people don't like MLK. It's what I was able to understand is a lot of black people didn't want to be integrated. They wanted to be, they
no,
felt like they were doing
true.
Better segregated.
That's not
no,
true.
They thought he was a sellout.
I didn't say it was true or not. I said that's the understanding I got
integration,
from it.
Integration in reality, listen, anybody can look back in hindsight and say, oh, this was bad. Fuck no. The reality is that overwhelming majority of black people, and if you study history, overwhelming majority of black people, integration was a choice. Integration was the option to be able to do what you wanted to do. It was to prevent you from not having to only go to this one thing to give you the option to be able to do what you. It was freedom.
Yeah.
That's all integration was the freedom to choose. What you see black people saying today, the people that argue against it, what they saying today is basically saying, listen, I wanted you to tell me what it is that I could do so you can guarantee my success. Bitch, you got more freedom today to do anything you want to do, and you still don't even go to a library. Every single library, the ones that you didn't have access to, they open and they empty. Empty. You have the option to be able to do anything you want to do right now. You can literally go to school for free. For free. You go to college and you fuck off the tuition money, and then you blame the system and say it's systematic oppression. Integration did nothing except to give you the option to be able to do even more.
What state are you in where college is free?
College is free everywhere.
If you are below a certain level and you start off at community college, and you start off at community, that's because they give you the option to be able to take it. You don't have to take it. If you are
below
a certain threshold,
low income,
and you go to community college, you can literally go to school for the first 2 years and get your associate's degree free. And then you can really finesse the system, because the way that I did it, I went to community college for my first 2 years, basically, practically free, because the credit hours was so little. And then I went and got a job. And people say, well, Anton, why did you go and get a job at the University of Michigan when you graduated school? Well, because the University of Michigan not only double matched my 401k, where actually it was a 403b, they had the best benefits for my family. I already had a business to where I didn't have to use the money from my salary in order to substantiate myself. So then I let the university pay for my education when I went over into a major university. They literally paid for me to go to school after I graduated from community college, because they was incentivized, and the university actually had a program that allowed me to do so. Now, when I get that level of game out and I give it to the Patreon members and I give it to the people that I coach, and I say, listen, you can literally go through all 4 years for free, come out with zero student loans in debt, go into a STEM field, make all of the money, be able to keep all of it in, then continue to substantiate yourself by building up your 401k, by going to a public university or going into a government, right?
Because what if I just want to go into business?
But people don't want to hear that.
What if I just want to go into business?
Listen, you have the option to do what you want to do. I don't want to hear any excuses from anybody as to why they can't do the thing that they're supposed to do.
So are you saying that was there economic integration? Was there economic integration?
Yes, there is.
So
Bruiser,
here's the thing.
So everything Anton just said, he was saying in a integration.
He was talking about the Department of Education.
Hold on. Not only can you do exactly what Anton said, go to those same places, the library, your city hall, and ask what programs that are there specifically for black people, and they will throw a whole book on the damn table.
I'm not denying that.
And they still don't do that.
My question is it safe to say that integration only went to certain parts of the way of life or survival? As far as there was no housing integration. There was school integration, but there was no economic integration.
What is housing integration?
Think about this for a second, Bruce.
Go try to sell your house with the pictures
word
of your face online.
I literally gave you word
for
word.
See your appraisal value. Go ahead, Anton. My bad. I was answering.
I literally just gave you word for word the blueprint of how you can get a free education and get a STEM field degree.
I don't disagree with that. I was talking about people who want to just go into business. Because everybody's not going to college, are they?
Here's the beautiful thing about it. Even if you go into business, that is your decision. Be willing to fail or succeed based off of your own merit. Nobody owes you anything.
Bruce, what are you talking about, bro?
If you want to go into business as a black person, do you know that there are grants specifically for you to do that?
They have it for like people who don't have as much money or abandoned. They have programs for people to just do trading.
Exactly.
That's how it started, really. Like,
Listen, I'm just asking questions. I'm not trying to argue. All I'm asking is someone convince me that a black person can graduate high school and go get a $20,000 business loan before he get a $20,000 school loan.
But you don't need a business loan, and I would also say that is a bad idea because you still don't know how to run a business. Just because you're getting a loan don't mean you're going to be successful.
Right.
You don't need a loan. We are being taught wrong. We are you're supposed to reverse engineer what success looks like. This is not it. I literally just gave people the blueprint. Listen, if you don't make no money and you poor, right? You have a better chance at being successful when it comes to college as far as funding your college and a better chance of coming out without any student loans than somebody who's solidly middle class and parents don't qualify in order for you to be able to get a Pell Grant.
The only two things in life that make it worth living is guitars tuned good and firm feeling women. I don't need my name in the marquee lights. Got my song, got you with me tonight. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Lou Berry's train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. So baby, let's sell your diamond ring, buy some boots and faded jeans and go away. This coat and tie is choking me. In your high society, you cry all day. We've been so busy keeping up with the Joneses, four-car garage, and we're still building on. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas. Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Lou Berry's train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Willie and Waylon and boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and the McCoys. Between the Hank Williams pain songs and Jerry Jeff train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, there ain't nobody feeling no pain.
In July, we brought you a story about poverty in Alabama, which was spurred by a report from the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston. Alston toured America, spotlighting third-world-style poverty in our first-world country. NewsHour Weekend Special Correspondent Simon Ostrowski continues following in Alston's footsteps with a report on poverty in Los Angeles. Supported in part by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, this report is part of our ongoing series about poverty and opportunity in America, Chasing the Dream.
Los Angeles, the home of some of the most desirable zip codes in the country. But right at the heart of this wealthy metropolis exist conditions that have been described by the city's own newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, as a national disgrace. One expanse of 50 city blocks is an area that's become synonymous with poverty, crime, and homelessness. It's existed for decades and has dogged successive mayoral administrations that have tried to eradicate it. It's called Skid Row, and is home to an estimated 2,000 members of Los Angeles County's homeless community.
L.A. has one of the highest rents in the nation. And the reason why I come, there's so many tents out here because people can't afford to live in a house.
Steve Richardson, who goes by the name General Dogon, is an activist at the L.A. Community Action Network, which advocates for the city's homeless community.
The majority of the people that you see sleeping on the streets are black, and these are folks that have fell through the poverty level. It makes me really mad.
Along the subject of local and national concern, Skid Row recently garnered international attention when it became the focus of a report written by the United Nations Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, Philip Alston, whose job more often involves assessing conditions in the developing world.
The homelessness on the streets in LA is pretty staggering in terms of magnitude, in terms of how long running it is. There is a chronic shortage of affordable housing.
Nationally, homelessness has been mostly on the decline since 2010, though it ticked upward slightly in 2017 to nearly 554,000 people without their own roof over their heads in a so-called point-in-time count. The Los Angeles area, meanwhile, has trended in the opposite direction as the cost of living here soared over the last decade, forcing thousands onto the street in what has amounted to a nearly 50% increase in homelessness since 2012 to almost 53,000 people. The sheer size of Skid Row makes it look like a refugee camp. But according to a 2017 report by several homelessness advocacy groups, the availability of toilets here is worse than in a UN-run Syrian refugee camp.
It smells of urine everywhere. Skid Row had about 10 toilets, I think, for thousands of people. So it's a pretty bad setup.
So this is, call it the Big Green Machine, and it's a bathroom.
According to the LA Community Action Network, nearly 1,800 unsheltered people in Skid Row share access to just 9 toilets like this one, which means many avoid them altogether and use buckets, which are then emptied into the streets and trash cans.
And that was PTSD, but I didn't know nothing about that.
Willie Van Seals is a Vietnam vet suffering from heroin addiction, one of almost 3,900 homeless veterans in L.A. County.
I'll show you. The buckets that we use are urinate, bowel movement. There's nowhere around here to use the bathroom. And that's hard on a person. You know what I mean? Especially you got to walk around and find somewhere to take a crap. Yeah. Come on now.
The authorities know hygiene is an issue here. The county health department reported that its teams observed feces and urine on 8 of 10 sidewalks during a survey back in 2012. Street washes like this one have been instituted to help stop the spread of disease.
If we don't power wash the streets, we end up with what we had years ago when we had a tuberculosis outbreak or hepatitis outbreak or some kind of disease. It has to be done. It has to be done.
Officer Dion Joseph has been patrolling the streets of Skid Row for close to 2 decades. He says he's seen well-meaning policies to improve health conditions backfire.
Years ago, we had 27 porta potties in Skid Row. My concern was that they would be taken over by the criminal element. And day one, that's exactly what happened. When those bathrooms were here, gangsters were charging the homeless $1 to $5 to use the porta potties for what they were designed for.
While we're with him, Officer Joseph receives a complaint.
I've got these people who've pulled up in front of the doorway. I've asked them repeatedly to move. And trying to have a rational conversation with the irrational people, I just don't want to do it.
How are you? I'm sorry to bother you. There's a gentleman here who has a business, and the law says you can't be within 10 feet of his doorway. Can you guys move about 10 feet this way so we can have his space?
he resolves the situation without incident. But the UN report points to data from the LA Times showing that 14,000 homeless people were arrested in LA in 2016, a 31% increase since 2011. The report encouraged authorities to shift from a criminal justice response to a human rights-centered response to homelessness.
Homelessness is being criminalized in many ways, and it's as though you sort of keep moving the pieces around the chessboard and suddenly it's going to improve. Instead of saying, okay, we actually need to work out how to create places where these people can go.
I agree with the UN. We shouldn't be the tip of the spear. Fix the system, especially in places like Skid Row, where many individuals struggle with dual diagnosis, where they're addicts and mentally ill. We don't want to be the tip of the spear, but we have to be until a solution's arrived.
According to Victor Hinderleiter of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, mental health and addiction are a huge factor contributing to homelessness.
Approximately 30% of people experiencing homelessness self-report that they have a severe mental health disorder. About 30% of people experiencing homelessness self-report that they have a substance use disorder. Homelessness, in and of itself, is a traumatic experience.
Christina Miller, the LA Mayor's Senior Project Manager of Homeless Strategies, agrees that addressing homelessness is a multi-tiered process, but disagrees that the homeless are being criminalized.
And instead of leading with police, leading with enforcement, we are doing everything we can to lead with services, because we know that police officers are not social workers, that it's not necessarily in their purview, and having an enforcement-heavy response is not ultimately going to get people off the streets.
Activists say they know what will get people off the streets.
The solution is simple. This is what the solution is. This is the only thing that ends homelessness, is this right here, house keys. And until everybody got them, hey, you got to be good neighbors, because there's going to be people sleeping on the streets.
There are a lot of solutions that we are focusing on currently in terms of trying to expand our interim shelter bed capacity. But we also know what the only solution is to homelessness, which is permanent housing.
Miller told NewsHour Weekend the city of L.A. had embarked on an unprecedented drive to build 10,000 units of housing for the chronically homeless, those who've repeatedly ended up on the streets or been there for at least a year. It's funded through a $1.2 billion city bond over the next 10 years. That's in addition to a $30 million bridge home program directed at providing interim housing in the meantime. And the efforts may have started to pay off. This year, the homeless count in L.A. County went down for the first time since 2014, only modestly, from 55,000 people to just under 53,000, but it bucks a six-year-long trend in the opposite direction.
We are cautiously optimistic. We are celebrating the fact that there seems to be a change in the direction of the trajectory, and it does tell us that we're doing something right.
Well, they were considerate enough to give us a pantry.
Jose Soto, another veteran, is one of the lucky ones who's recently been housed after years in and out of prison in Skid Row.
I'm really happy with the closet space, but what do you fill it with?
Soto, who's in recovery from drug and alcohol addiction, gave us a tour of the residence the city's provided to him free of charge.
I've been on and off the streets for, 14 years. And in my situation, it was all due to substance abuse. I just like to get drunk a lot every day. And then before you know it, the lifestyle catches up and I'm one of the people on Skid Row or under a bridge.
Until newer housing comes online, homes like this are in very limited supply. Only veterans who've gone through a lengthy recovery process from substance abuse qualify for this building.
They treat us like trash.
For vet Willie Van Seals, who's still struggling with addiction, that seems like a distant prospect.
I went to the rehab.
Okay.
And when I went through, they promised me, when I got through, that they would actually give me my voucher and I could go and find me a place to stay.
Okay.
And none of that happened. Okay. This is where I ended up at.
So did you manage to kick the habit in rehab?
Nah. America paints herself as a good Samaritan country. I'm glad the UN came here, because you see third world conditions right here, you know, in the richest country in the world, that's worse than other countries.
The United Nations report notwithstanding, there are other indications things may be improving for the homeless in LA. In 2016, Angelenos voted overwhelmingly for a tax increase directed at funding the creation of homes for the chronically homeless. And while tents still line the streets of Skid Row, this year, chronic homelessness has dropped 18% in L.A. County.
When it rains, you must have something on this floor.
But for Willie Van Seals and others like him, Los Angeles still has a long way to go.
Pusher. I done had some things happen to me, man. President Obama's transition team.
So when people try to figure out how to make $1 million, they have no idea how daunting that is. Because if you know how to make $1 million, you're going to make it tomorrow. But since you can't figure out how to $1 million idea, you go somewhere and sit down. That's the wrong approach. If you apply your gift, your God-given gift that he gave you, you have millions already at your disposal. If you break it down inch by inch into things that sense, or the 10 by 10 theory, which is very simple. You don't need $1 million idea. You need a $10 idea. You need something that you do, your gift that God gave you, to make $10. That's all you got to be able to know. I don't care if it's cutting hair, cutting somebody's grass, washing somebody's car. I don't care if it's mowing somebody's lawn. I don't care if it's driving people to their destinations. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's baking cookies or pie. You have some braiding somebody's hair. You have something that you can do so well that someone will give you $10 for it. Write my paper for me. Do this for me. Somebody give you $10 for it. Once they give you $10, all you got to do is whatever you did to get that 10, do it 10 more times. You now, my friend, have $100. You have $100 simply because you took a $10 idea and you did it 10 times. Well, guess what? If you take that $100 that you made since you've done it 10 times and you do it 10 more times, I got news for you, my friend. You now have $1,000. $1,000, you make $1,000, guess what all you got to do? You got to multiply that effort again. Do whatever you did to do $1,000, do it 10 more times. My friend, you now have $10,000. You got $10,000 now. Imagine if you was making an extra $10,000 a month. Just imagine if you was making an extra $10,000 a month. That's $120,000 a year. But I got news for you, my friend. Whatever you did, whatever it took to make yourself $10,000, all you got to do is do it 10 more times. 10 more times, my friend, you now have $100,000. I got news for you now. If you can make $100,000, you're just a step away from being a millionaire, man. Because now you hire a few more people to help you out, that you can do portions of what you do so you can duplicate that effort. And one more time, just one more time, do it 10 times. Man, that sounds hard. It is hard. But what else you got to do? What, you going to stop at the 100,000? All you got to do is duplicate your efforts by 10. You duplicate your efforts by 10 times 100,000. Welcome to the club, my friends. You are now a millionaire. Congratulations. You became a millionaire with a $10 idea. So stop bogging yourself down trying to figure out how to make a million. Do what you can do to make $10. And then do the 10 by 10 theory. inch by inch, anything's a cinch. Now, here's the joyful part. Along the way, when you was down here making $20,000, but you did right here, and now all of a sudden you're making $30,000. Now you're making $100,000. But on the way to duplicating that times 10, you may stop along in here at $250,000. You got making $250,000 a year. That's way better than that $20,000 you had when you started. So there's joy in the process. Your life is actually a lot richer at $250,000. It'll become even more richer at $500,000. It becomes even richer than that at $750,000, $750,000. If you don't get to the million, man, you're going to trip because you're making $900,000 a year? No, you're going to be happy. But you don't make the million, so you only make $700,000 a year? You can't find happiness in $7,000? Something wrong with you, man. There's joy in the process. That's how you make $1,000,000.
We want them to be themselves, and I told them, be yourselves and say what you want to say. Don't worry about me. And I'm going to do the right thing, whatever it is. I may be right.
Two things are going to happen. There's going to be a lesson, and there's going to be a blessing. Every failure is a lesson and a blessing. Every failure, there is a lesson and a blessing. Let me tell you something. You know how many mistakes I've made? Last January, I hosted Miss Universe. What you laughing at? Why is your ass laughing? In 89 countries. Now here's the way God works. I'll tell you how crazy this is. On my vision board, the part you don't see, because I have another list. I have one. I can't show you this because it's not going to show up. But I have a morning gratitude prayer. And you can't see it. But this is everything I wake up before I talk to my wife. I thank God for about 64 things before I ask him for anything. Then after that, it's about another 50 things that I'm asking him for. With all I have, I got about 50 things that I'm asking for. One of the things on my list that I asked God for was to increase my global persona. I want to increase my global persona. I want my message, my motivational speaking, to go global, worldwide. I want to share with more people how to become successful and teach it to them real simple. See, I ain't saying nothing heavy today. If you don't understand that means something wrong with you. You ain't gonna make it. Thanks for coming. But you're super slow if you ain't getting my time. Because I ain't no brilliant cat. I just know how to keep it real simple, right? So in asking God to increase my global persona, he made me the first African-American host ever in the history of the Miss Universe pageant. But he didn't stop there. He allowed me to make the biggest mistake ever made on national global television. That mistake, 48 hours later, I was trending so hard on Google and social media, my name in 48 hours had been typed in 4 billion times. In 48 hours. After a week was up, Steve Harvey had been Googled 7 billion times.
Wow. appreciate the way God chose to increase my global concern. I didn't like that one at all. I was a little ticked off with God for a minute. Because in truth, what happened was, it wasn't a mistake I made. I just ate it for everybody. See, the teleprompter, I'm a smart guy. I've been on TV a long time. And the new 2015 Miss Universe is? That's what the teleprompter said. The IVF in my ear says, read the next name. We have rehearsed it this way for 3 days. It was only two names on the card. They put a third name in the corner, never told me. We had changed. It wasn't going to be no first runner up. The guy said, read the next name on the card. Hold now. Next name on the card, Miss Columbia. Great job, Steve. Go for the setup to close. I go in the back. I'm chilling. Steve, you killed it. I know. Steve, you good. You're the greatest. But won't he do it? Then all I heard was cussing. I just heard white people in my ear just cussing. What do you mean? That's the wrong name. The guy said, we'll straighten it out tomorrow in the media. I said, no, we straighten it out tonight. I walked back out there on my own. I didn't tell them that the teleprompter was wrong. I didn't tell them that the dude told me to say this in my ear. I didn't tell them that they changed the car from her. I stood there and I ate it. The way my father raised me. Be a man. Go out there and open up. If I'd have blamed the teleprompter, he'd never work in Hollywood again. The director would have been fired and out of work. Cue card lady, her job gone. I got 5 shows. I take this hit. So I took it. Boy, they laughed at me. People I thought was my friends turned on me. They were doing memes on me. Oh, they was black. See, y'all ain't still mad. They talked about me. I got death threats from Columbia. We have 24-hour security inside of our gates now because of Miss Universe.
Wow.
People was coming by my house, man, taking pictures. Them Colombians was mad. You know, this is the drug cartel. You got to be serious with these people. And they're going to get them wrong. I don't even know Spanish, but I know when I'm getting cussed out. I don't know what punta is, but I was punta so many damn times. I don't know what it is, but I was one. But behind every mistake, every moment of adversity, there's a lesson and a blessing. The lesson was, I learned something that day. From now on, before I do anything, I double check everybody. So that's the lesson. So now, Steve Harvey, I don't care what the teleprompter say. And we're going to talk to some people first. That's the lesson. Here comes the blessing. 4 weeks later, T-Mobile calls. They said, Steve, we want you to do a Super Bowl promotion. They said, we're going to do a spoof on the Miss Universe thing. I said, I'm not doing that, man. I'm sick of that. Then they told me how much they paid. So I went and shot the Super Bowl. I made so much money and charged them so much money for one commercial that it paid for everything I had for 2 years. Then I turn around and now I am part owner of the Miss Universe pageant, Miss Teen USA, and Miss America. There's a lesson and a blessing.
Yeah.
You gotta hang in there with it when it gets funky for you.
Yeah.
Now, y'all, I'm telling you all this because I'm telling you some things that's going on. But God wants you to be great. Being rich is okay. But in order to get where you're going, You got to remember this. Everybody come with you, can't go with you.
Amen.
Uh-oh, this is the hard part. So listen to this careful. Everybody come with you, can't go with you. You got to get like-minded people around you. You got to surround yourself with everybody on the same page. I told you, these dudes, look at this picture. They going out on a hunt. Look at their face. They're serious, man. Ain't nobody playing. They don't bring the Cubs. The Cubs can't make it on this trip. Everybody come with you, can't go with you. When it's time to kill to eat, you got to get like-minded people around you. Everybody come with you, can't go with you. If you're too old, you can't rest this hunt up. Sorry, you got to stay back at the house. You got to surround yourself with like-minded people. It's time to go get it. I told you, I ain't bring these just because I was here. All these on my phone. Everybody come with you, can't go with you. Sometimes you got to cut your family loose. Sometimes your friends is the one. Association brings on participation. If you're sitting around friends and all they doing is getting high, guess what you're going to do? You're going to get high with them. What, you stupid? If all your friends is talking about we're going to gang bang, we're going to slam this dope, we're going to rob and steal, guess what you're going to do? You're going to sell dope. You're going to rob and steal. If all your girlfriends is always gossiping, guess what you're doing? You listening. So instead of going out on your mission, you're sitting around gossiping. Sometimes in order to get where you're going, you got to cut some people loose. Let me teach you this here. This man told me one time, if you ever watch a rocket ship that's blasting off, you'll notice that it's four tanks around this rocket ship. 5, 4, 3, 2. You'll notice two of them stay on the ground. And that rocket starts coming up. Two of them stay attached to the rocket. But you watch that rocket, and once it gets up so high, you see another tank fall off. Then you watch the rocket get a little bit higher. The last tank falls off because it's necessary to rid yourself of the dead weight so that you can orbit as high as God has intended for you. But you gotta lose these people. See, everybody come with you, can't go with you. Yeah, we was friends and we was homies. Yeah, you might ride or die. But I'm trying to go somewhere else now. Your negative attitude is slowing me down. Your gossiping is always, your hatred is pushing me. You got to go. You got to let that tank go. Now, you want to go to where God got for you, or you want to hang on with your friends? What you going to do? Everybody come with you, can't go with you.
Maximizing the gift that God put on the inside of you.
I knew that if God ordered the meal, he was responsible for the bill. And I felt like he was going to pay for it.
If he gave you the vision, he'll provide the provision.
I had $5 left in this plan, and I hadn't even fed my family of 8. And that day, I took that 5 and turned it into 60. I took that 60, put the 5 back that I started with, and turned that into 600 by the end of the week. And that is the same money that I've been flipping for 17 years. I did it with no debt. I did it with no knowledge of the business. I did it with no experience. And for all the people who got something to say about it, I did it with no credit too. So when they say, ain't no way, there was more to the story than that.
Yeah.
Now, before we hop into today's show, be sure to like, comment, and subscribe. Now let's jump into the video.
So, Mignon, I didn't know this about your story. And I've known you for years now. And if I am correct, you were a teen mom. When did you have your first?
I had my first baby in 1993. And I had just graduated from high school.
Okay.
But I graduated from high school a year early. So I had gone to college early. Nobody prepared me for what the party was going to be like on an HBCU campus.
Oh, man.
So second semester, I'm bringing home a baby bumblebee.
Are you serious? What HBCU did you go to?
I went to Xavier University.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
And the shocking thing to me, and this is why I love your story, because every time we do something like this, right, something powerful comes from it, and I learn something brand new from you. And you had five kids before 25?
Yeah, I had five kids at 21.
21?
Yeah, by the time I was 21, I had five children. Three of them were a wedding present.
Okay.
And then two of them I had given birth to, and I had my sixth one at 27.
27?
Yeah.
And didn't drop out of college?
No, it just took me a little bit longer. I even took my children to school with me.
What?
Sometimes they were in class. My baby Dylan, who now runs the business, would sit in the back of my Bible class. He would never be silent. He would never sit still. But when I needed him to go to class, it's like something happened to him, and he would just color until the class was over. Man. Like, God, shut that baby's mouth so I can graduate.
Man. And today, we won't tell the people how old you are. You still look about 30 years old. You know what I'm saying? But today you're running a multi-million-dollar cupcake business. And I don't think it's a cupcake business. I think that you're running a multi-million-dollar ministry. Because when people experience you and your cupcakes and your team, your staff, it's just a different experience, right? And I want to talk about that because some people are experiencing you for the first time here on my show.
Mm-hmm.
And when people experience you, what do they get? I know what I get. Yeah. I get a deeper side of you. But when people experience you for the first time, what will they get? I'm curious.
I'm hoping that they get joy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's my mission in life. I want to leave everyone experiencing Mignon Francois with joy.
Yeah.
And I feel like there is such a big value for joy in heaven because in the Bible it says those who sow in tears will reap in joy. And when you think about sowing and planting, it takes time for a harvest to grow. And I just think that when that harvest is joy coming out of the things you've gone through, it just lets you know that everything that's happening to you is happening for you.
Yeah.
It's something that you can plant, and something is going to grow out of it. And I believe that's what my whole experience has been about.
Yeah. And so you wrote a book.
I wrote a book.
You wrote a book. And this book, I was emotional when I read it. This is not the book. I want it to be fresh. I actually read a PDF version that your team sent over. And it's called Made from Scratch, Finding Success Without a Recipe. And inside of this book, you talk a lot about choosing life. And really, if you just follow you, you're always promoting choose life.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean exactly? Choose life.
That's such a good question. I was being awakened at 3:17 every morning, and it was like clockwork. Like, you ever saw that movie Groundhog's Day? I would turn over and see the clock. It would say 3:17. I would just awaken.
Wow.
And so I got up. I would check the house, check the stove, make sure my children were breathing.
Yeah.
And one particular day, I couldn't go back to sleep. And so I turned on the TV. And to me, the best television is either during Black History Month on TBS or fundraising time.
Right.
And there was a guy on TV. He's passed away now. His name was Wayne Dyer. He said, "The morning breeze has something to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Do not go back to sleep." And that sounded crazy to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know nothing about no morning breeze talking to me. All I'm listening for is Jesus now.
Yeah.
And so he said it a couple times. But the third time he said it was, "God is trying to speak to you, and this is the only time you'll listen."
Mm-hmm.
And so while you think that you're getting up to check the stove and the door and stuff, you're actually getting up to spend time with God because this is the only time you're silent enough to listen.
Wow.
And so I was like, okay, well, he can stay on my TV. And I listened more. He then began to explain that it would take me a week now to get out of the bed, now that I knew that that's what I was getting up for.
Mm.
He was right. But he said, just put your feet on the floor. Eventually, you'll stand up. And that's exactly what happened. I found myself back in the same place where I had started. And underneath the table, I saw my Bible there. Because I was sitting there, okay, God, you want to talk?
I don't know what you want to say. Please don't talk, because if I hear your voice right now, I'm just going to lose it. So don't say nothing. But I do want to hear, from you.
Yeah.
And so I saw my Bible and I decided to open it, and I just let it fall wherever it opened. It opened up to chapter 3 of a particular book. I believe it was Ephesians 3, and I started at verse 17, and I got my first message from God, and he let me know that he loved me, and he was about to show me that he had plans for me and that I needed to follow them. And so every morning, I would go to chapter 3, verse 17, read through until the end of the chapter or until it didn't make any more sense, and then I go on to the next book. I read the whole Bible like that at 3:17 every morning for weeks. When God stopped awakening me on the last day, I fell into Deuteronomy, I believe it was chapter 30, and also in Joshua. And I think that was Joshua 1. It was like the first chapter of Joshua. And God said, I'm sitting before you, life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life. And what it said to me was, I've given you a lot of businesses, Mignon. I have had so many business ideas, and you start them, and you stop them, and you don't follow through. And God said to me, I'm not giving you nothing else.
According to recent stats, only about half of African Americans have some form of estate planning put into place. This includes important documents like your wills, your trust, and your power of attorneys. Additionally, only about 60% of all people have life insurance coverage. But why is it so important for not just black people, but all of us to have these things put into place? You see, life insurance can provide financial protection for your loved ones in the event of your unexpected death. It can help cover funeral and burial expenses, pay off debts, and even your mortgages. But here's what I really want you to consider. It can provide income for your loved ones to build wealth with. You see, estate planning, on the other hand, can help ensure that your assets are distributed according to your wishes after your death, and that your loved ones are taken care of. If you truly love, and I mean this, if you truly, truly love your loved ones, don't leave their financial security at chance. I want you to get life insurance today. You can get a free quote with my friends over at Ethos by visiting anthonyoneal.com/life insurance or by clicking the link in today's show notes. Protect your family's future and give yourself peace of mind. Don't be in heaven and you're full of joy and your family is here on earth struggling and stressed. Get life insurance today with my friends over at Ethos.
At Jiffy Lube, we care about cars. In fact, we're kinda obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts will check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll care for your car like we care for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.